Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we are privileged to be able to tap each week on matters involving American security and interests in Asia is with us, I'm pleased to say. He is Gordon Chang. He is, of course, a columnist for the Daily Beast, a frequent contributor to Fox News, a regular on this program, I'm pleased to say, and the author of two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, welcome. It's so good to have you, especially when there's so much going on in your part of the portfolio that we're interested in talking about.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
So I wanted to figure out, if we could, Gordon, what should be made of, well, I guess I could only call it a sort of spectacle in Korea. The games are underway, the Olympic Games, of course. We had the North and South Korean combined Olympic teams parading around. The Vice President of the United States was there, and he took, I think properly, a rather dim view of all of this, but it was kind of lost in all of the palaver about what a breakthrough this is. Is it a breakthrough, or is this really problematic?
Well, you know, certainly North Korea's invitation to President Moon Jae-in of South Korea to visit Pyongyang is not a good development. In the past, there have been two inter-Korean summits, both of them in the North Korean capital, and there have been large payments from South Korea to North Korea to facilitate those meetings. And the question is, what will the South Koreans, if anything, give to the North Koreans if there's going to be a third inter-Korean summit? Moon Jae-in is from a generation that is Korean nationalist. They see one Korean state, and so therefore they view North Korea in very different terms than we do, and in very different terms than other South Koreans do. In South Korea right now, the important thing, and this is important for the U.S., and that is people there see their society as separate and apart from North Korea. So they are South Korean nationalists. And so Moon is losing a good part of his base by trying to have this reconciliation with the North. And then in addition to the South Korean nationalists, you have the conservatives, generally older South Koreans who remember the Korean War, very pro-American. And what is important for Vice President Pence is that we're in a struggle for hearts and minds in South Korea. And I understand the impulse of the vice president not to stand when the unified Korean team entered the stadium. But what he did, though, in the view of many South Koreans, is insult them. And that's not going to be very helpful because we're going to need their help in hemming in their very pro-North Korean president, Moon Jae-in. This is a struggle, hearts and minds. We need to win it. Vice President Pence, by sitting down, didn't help.
Yeah, it was kind of a lose-lose situation, though. I think there's very little doubt that had he stood and applauded with others, that it would have probably helped the wrong team as well. Gordon, let me ask you, he has had conversations apparently with President Moon, Vice President Pence, that is, while he was over there, in which they apparently agreed to some understandings about how this rapprochement with the North Koreans was going to be pursued. What do we know about that? And how much do you think is probably unknown at this point, or certainly not being discussed, that might be of concern?
Vice President Pence, according to Josh Rogan in a Washington Post report today, apparently had substantive conversations with Moon Jae-in. We're concerned, as we mentioned, about Moon providing assistance and support to North Korea. Apparently, Moon agreed not to do that. He agreed to support American efforts to increase sanctions. And Vice President Pence said that the Trump administration agreed to talk to the North Koreans without preconditions. This is a change in American policy, which has insisted that the North Koreans acknowledge their prior agreements to give up their nuclear weapons. So this was an attempt on the part of the vice president to prevent a break with South Korea. The North Koreans, by this Olympic initiative, wanted to drive a wedge between the alliance, between South Korea and the United States. Vice President Pence's agreement, if it's accurate, and it does seem to be so, very much would prevent that from happening. But it does it at a cost to the American position on denuclearization.
And, you know, Gordon, I'm thinking as we talk about this of the susceptibility of particularly people in the press, but evidently some at least on the ground in South Korea as well, to these sorts of charm offensives by the North Korean regime. In this case, I guess, in the person of the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un's sister, who was present in South Korea for the Olympic Games. It contrasts so sharply with the image that we had that the President of the United States used, I think, to great effect in his State of the Union address of a North Korean defector, you know, holding up the crutches that were sort of symbols of his persecution and hardship in North Korea, and that of countless others. Gordon Chang, as you look at this, are we really risking mistaking what is going on at the moment for any real substantive change in the position, or for that matter, the threat posed by North Korea, not just to the South Koreans, for heaven's sakes, or Japan, but also to us? And I just, in that connection, if I could just mention, one of the things that was on display in a military parade, as you know, in Pyongyang on the eve of these Olympic Games and all of this falderal, were a number of missiles, ballistic missiles, on what appeared to be Chinese or Chinese knockoff transporter erector launchers. Talk about all that, if you would, Gordon.
Yeah. One of the things that Vice President Pence on Friday did, which was extremely good, was he highlighted, first of all, North Korean aggression, because he went to the Chonan Memorial, which honors the 46 South Korean sailors who were killed by a North Korean torpedo in March 2010. And then he met with defectors. And that was an important story to the North Koreans, to the South Koreans, about the human rights situation in the North. That was very effective public diplomacy on the part of the vice president, because he was reminding the South Koreans that, yeah, there is a charm offensive, but don't be fooled. You know, with regard to the Chinese transporter erector launchers, you know, Beijing admitted that they sold the chassis for these. And the New York Times reported that the Chinese told us that the North Koreans told them that they only wanted them for logging, which makes no sense on any level, especially because these chassis are wider than the roads leading to North Korea's logging areas. But privately, U.S. intelligence sources say that we actually talked to the Chinese before the sale, not after, as the New York Times reported. And the Chinese went ahead and sold these chassis anyway. And the Chinese probably also sold the missile interface, in other words, the entire vehicle. We have yet to impose costs on China for doing so. This makes these North Korean missiles very dangerous to us. And this is, again, a failure of the Obama administration, and indeed now of the Trump administration, to make sure Beijing doesn't do this. So we've had another reminder at this big military parade that the North Koreans and the Chinese are working together.
Yeah. And let's be clear, for the purposes of the audience's understanding of the important point you just made, Gordon Chang, when you say that these transporter erector launchers make these missiles more dangerous to us, among others, this assumes that they will in due course be fitted with even longer range missiles than those on parade. But the point is that by virtue of their mobility, they are giving the North Koreans an opportunity to have essentially an undetectable first launch capacity against us, something that is exceedingly problematic as we seek to try to contain this, or better yet, undo this threat from North Korea enabled by communist China. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment today. Thank you very much for this update on the charm offensive and how truly uncharming the North Koreans are. We'll look forward to picking up with you again next week. In the meantime, thank you, my friend, for joining us. Keep up the great work at the Daily Beast and Fox and elsewhere. Join us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Major Fred Galvin, United States Marines Corps retired, on the fate of the MARSOC 7 and what we can do to help them right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It is with the greatest of pleasure to say, joined by Major Fred Galvin, United States Marine Corps retired. He is an extraordinary man with a record of service to his country that I think is of the highest order. He served in the force reconnaissance units, the special operators of the United States Marine Corps, what came to be called Marine Special Operations Command, the Raiders. He has acquitted himself brilliantly in a host of command positions over the years, but had the unhappy and really tragic experience during his service in Afghanistan in 2007 of being subjected, along with six of his men, to a vicious and potentially fatal ambush. And it is to their great credit, evidence of their skill as well as their courage, that they were able to extricate themselves from that ambush without losing a man, only to discover, upon returning to their base, that something dreadful had befallen them. To talk about that and to hear about some very significant progress in sorting all this out and restoring the good reputation of these men known as the MARSOC 7. I'm thrilled to have Major Galvin with us again. Major, welcome back. And we're going to get into why congratulations are in order, but let me say congratulations to you and your men. Tell us what happened when you got back to the base. Just remind us of that, and then we'll talk about what happened recently.
Yes, sir. The morning of the 4th of March, we engaged the tribal leaders in this small village right next to the Pakistan border with Afghanistan. And as we approached the village, we were attacked by a car bomb and jihadist fighters shooting at us on both sides of the road. That resulted in our response, which we killed those jihadists that were shooting at us, and we returned to the base. And within 20 minutes of our patrol being ambushed, this was already out on BBC that said we had killed 19 and wounded 50 women and children, and that ended up spreading all throughout the mainstream media, the New York Times.
So the BBC charged you with war crimes, effectively, and it was all over the international press within minutes of the incident. I assume that that was not an accident, that this was an information operation by the enemy. But what happened within your own chain of command, Fred Galvin?
And so the next step was, you know, a pre-planned rioting in the streets that got the attention of Hamid Karzai, who is the prime minister. And as it's well documented in the press, especially the March 2007 Washington Examiner, you know, Karzai pressured the American generals and they kicked us out. And that happened in March 2007, long before the 5 April 2007 investigation was completed. So that led to more slander in the press, led to senior army generals making comments that was unprecedented, saying that we killed women and children, which was completely false.
One of them, by the way, of course, was the man who is now the commander of all U.S. forces in Afghanistan, General John Nicholson, who, as I recall, described what you had done as a stain on our honor. That statement has not been retracted by the general, nor have others like it by others who were at the time in your chain of command. There has, however, thanks in no small measure to the very tireless efforts of your good self and of Congressman Walter Jones of North Carolina, an important breakthrough. You were, of course, acquitted of any such wrongdoing, but your reputations have suffered badly. Talk a little bit about that and what's just happened in the past couple of days.
We did go to court in January 2008, and it was a 3.5-week trial. This did create a lot of pressure on our Marines, as you can obviously know from they accused us of war crimes punishable by death, and our seven Marines ended up having serious issues with cancer, diabetes, divorce. That's led to this day to employment discrimination because our faces, our names, all this was out there in the press. Ever since Congressman Walter Jones stood up on the House floor in May of 2007, without any prompting of any of us, he knew that this was unjust, and he stated that our rights had been maligned, as they were, by these slanderous comments from these Army generals, and he demanded an apology. And what we saw last week on Wednesday, 7 February, was Congressman Walter Jones read a letter from the Commandant of the Marine Corps' office, and it stated some very powerful words that, quote, our conduct reflected sound military judgment. And that is the very first time publicly that any words to that effect had been said from the office of the Commandant of the Marine Corps.
What the Commandant has done is clearly an important, if long overdue, recognition. You have, however, as a team, as a group, again, among the most accomplished and skilled men we have in our military, suffered terribly. And as you've indicated, that we've not seen you get the kind of care and the kind of employment opportunities that you should. Talk a little bit about what can be done to remedy this situation, both further in terms of your reputation and also in terms of what people like us can do to help you and your team find employment opportunities to which you certainly are entitled.
Yes, sir. In the most effective way, because to counter a lot of the internal military politics, the slander that has slowed promotions, in my case and many others, it ended up pushing us out of the service because they would not promote us. So what we are seeking is the strongest symbol is to have a public ceremony where the Marines from the MARSOC 7 are awarded the newly approved. Since 2016, the Marine Raiders have designed a Marine Raider uniform insignia. This is a similar insignia that the Navy SEALs wear when they become qualified. It's a similar to the Army Special Forces, which wear the Green Beret. And we are requesting that the Commandant of the Marine Corps show that he is bringing the MARSOC 7 back into the fold so that our Marines who are still serving do not suffer anymore from slowed promotions or denied promotions. And those of us who are now outside of the Marine Corps, it is a very public sign, just like when we were going into the courtroom, left a lot of doubt of what went on. This would be a very public sign that we are accepted back into the fold and are in good standing with the Marine Corps, and that's what we seek.
It's the least we can do. Very quickly, sir, what can be done to help your men, who again are extremely impressive human beings, get employment opportunities that has thus far not been available to them?
There are several people who have reached out since last week, and we are very grateful for that. And probably the most important thing that an individual can do would be to have their congressman correspond with Congressman Jones's office and join his effort in allowing this very visual signal with awarding the Marine Raider badge. We do, if individuals, are interested in helping out, I would request that they coordinate with Congressman Walter Jones's office.
Terrific. We leave it at that. Major Fred Galvin, thank you for your service to our country, both in uniform and now out. I appreciate what you've done and notably the extraordinary lengths you've gone to try to make sure that the record is clear of the very distinguished conduct of your men in a very difficult circumstance. And God bless you, sir, and I hope that everyone in our listening audience will be very supportive of this effort. If you have ideas as to ways in which these men can find gainful employment, please let Major Galvin know as well. Is there a website that they could be directed to that might help in that regard?
Through our charity, it's called heroesunited.net.
Check it out. heroesunited.net. Major Fred Galvin, thank you. God bless you, sir. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll talk with Mike Gonzalez of the Heritage Foundation. We'll get into some very interesting subjects with him about Europe's war on speech and the U.S. Census coming up. What it might mean for you. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Mike Gonzalez, an old friend who is these days a senior fellow at the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies of the Heritage Foundation. He has served at Heritage for some time, including as its vice president for communications, but he's also a journalist by training, having spent some 20 years, much of it reporting from places in Europe, Asia, and Latin America. He's also been quite accomplished as a government speechwriter in the Securities and Exchange Commission and also in the State Department's European Bureau. He is a go-to man on a lot of very interesting subjects, and we're always delighted to have him with us. Mike, thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Frank, I'm delighted to be here with you and with your audience, of course.
Good. Well, look, I wanted to talk first with you about something that you picked up on in the context of a most unfortunate law enacted and recently signed into law by the Poles concerning discussion of the Holocaust and the role that Polish nationals played in it. But you made a larger point, which is one I'm very much alive to, and that is what is happening more generally in Europe with respect to restricting freedom of speech. Talk about both, if you would.
Yeah, you know, this is, of course, the Polish law, I think you and I agree, is pretty stupid. And there's still a chance that the Constitutional Court, the Supreme Court, will say it's not constitutional. But it was assigned by the president of Poland, Andrzej Duda. And what it says is that it's illegal to say that the Poles were responsible for the Holocaust, which, of course, was carried out by Nazis in occupied Poland. And it also makes illegal the phrase Polish death camps, which the Poles take great umbrage at and which was used by Barack Obama in 2012. And the Poles really protested that. And Barack Obama wrote a letter of regret to the Polish president. I have a great deal of sympathy for the Poles. You know, they were taken over and occupied by Nazis. But, you know, these are academic debates that is best left to academics. And but what I tried to do, as you said, is criticize the Polish government for a silly decision and a bad decision, but to explain that this is not Poland being uniquely authoritarian, but Poland really being European. The thing we conservatives have given the Polish government plaudits over is to because they have kept apart and tried to keep their own identity. Here, they're copying France and Germany and the UK in passing laws that restrict free speech, and that's really too bad.
Yeah, well, one of the particular concerns that I have, Mike, is that the European Union, in addition to a number of its member countries, has really been of late enforcing what I think amount to Sharia blasphemy restrictions. In other words, in the name of not offending Muslims, disallowing people from saying even truthful things about Sharia supremacism, for example. So this is a much larger problem than what we're seeing in Poland, unfortunately, and it really goes in a way to the heart of Western civilization that people are being restricted in being able to, again, speak accurately, even truthfully about concerns, let alone in other ways. Let me ask you about one of the other things that you've written about, which I commend you for following, as I think too few of us are, Mike Gonzalez, and that is what has been happening and is in the offing, for that matter, in terms of the census in this country. You've written about the fact that it contributes to government bloat. You also have written about what it plays a role in terms of, well, I guess identity politics is one way of putting it. Identitarian fever is another that you've coined a term for. Give us a flavor, Mike, of what's going on with all of that and why it should matter to all of us.
Well, you know, yeah, I think very much that the census, not only the census, but the federal government in general, but the census really is very important. It really contributes and creates the segmentation of the country into, what are really antagonistic groups that are organized along imagined very often imagine ethnic lines or sexual orientation and so forth. And what Barack Obama, at least his administration, tried to do at the very end, at the 11th hour, in September 2016, they had a multi-agency task force that issued a request that the census create yet another group, this one for MENA, Middle East and North Africa, residents of the United States, Americans and other residents who descend from very different peoples, people between Morocco and the Persian-Afghan border. So you're talking about people who are of Arab descent, of Berber descent, of Kurdistan descent, Persian, people who speak languages that are not related to each other, but in different families of languages and practice different religions. They wanted to create another pan-ethnic or ethno-racial group like they have done with so-called Hispanics, that they have done with Asians.
And what's the point of that? Why is this being done, in your estimation, Mike Gonzalez?
Well, the census, the people who are for this say, well, this is a way for us for people, allows people to find themselves. But what you have to understand is, the Indo-European root of the word census is to evoke something into being by naming it. So as Nathan Glazer said, the census actually, it encourages what it identifies and discourages what it doesn't identify. So if you're telling people that they belong in different groups, this is really the godfather of identity politics today. The reason we have the mess we have in our schools and universities, in which people just we have been balkanized, it starts all with the paperwork of the 60s and the 70s. With the EEO-1 form that in 1966, companies with over 100 employees are asked to fill out, the creation of protected classes. Then in 77, the Office of Management and Budget creates the David Hollinger called the ethno-racial pentagon of whites, blacks, Hispanics, Asian Americans, and Indian Americans. And that is, it gets really kind of ugly. This is really, people have said this really mirrors a racist talk.
Yeah, it does. And it's so at odds, Mike, as you point out in your piece about identity politics, and I can't tell where that appeared. Where did that appear? Was it Heritage?
It's at the Heritage website, the Daily Signal. We have a communications platform, the Daily Signal. That's where it appeared. But I've written about this issue for a very long time. I co-authored a piece with Ward Connolly for the Washington Post this year.
Right. But the point that I think you've made, which really can't be overemphasized, is this is all at odds with the whole concept of e pluribus unum, out of many, one. And the idea of an American identity that is transcendent of all of its component parts and made stronger by them. And, I'm thinking about this as we're at the eve of a major debate in the United States Senate on immigration policy. And I'm sure that we're going to hear an enormous amount about these identity politics, notably with respect to this issue of the so-called Dreamers. If there is an American dream, it seems to me, it's rooted really in this transcendent idea of the pluribus unum. Let me ask you about one other thing, Mike, very quickly before we go. There is, of course, a new budget in the capital city here. It is the budget of the President of the United States, only the real budget apparently has now been set in stone by a budget deal that he signed into law last week. What do you make of that budget deal and the fact that it's now essentially rendered completely irrelevant, whatever the president would like to see done?
This is a complete boondoggle. What is it, $63 billion in additional base spending? Speaker Ryan has a point when he says his discretionary spending is not really the problem, that the problem is in entitlements. But this amount of discretionary spending, in additional base spending, it's really very problematic.
And this was money, again, that was just thrown at the Democrats in order to buy them off because they would refuse to improve the funding of the military, which is so clearly needed, without some great new funding stream for their various Democratic domestic hobby horses. We have to leave it at that, Mike. I'm sorry to say there's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll give us a chance to do it often in 2018. And we appreciate your time, as always, and the great work you do at the Heritage Foundation. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Russ Dallin about developments in Latin America and what they mean for you right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is always a pleasure to have with us a man who has been following closely for years the developments in our own hemisphere, often from the front lines of what I think of as the war for the free world in places like Venezuela. His name is Russ Dallin. He is the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is also a man of finance and many other parts, a great resource for us on matters involving developments, not just in Venezuela, but in the region more generally. And the reporting that his paper does is extraordinarily important. And so it's always a privilege to be able to pick his brains a little bit about some of the developments that are going to matter probably in the near term to us, not just in the longer term, if things continue to go very badly south of our border. Russ Dallin, welcome back. It is always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's always a learning experience because of the Socratic nature of your questions.
You're the one who's teaching. Listen, I did want to just mention before we get into the latest developments on Latin America that President apparently spoke rather directly and I think properly about oppression in our hemisphere of Christians, among others, in the course of his remarks at the National Prayer Breakfast last week. And he denounced in the context of that oppression specifically what Cuba and Venezuela have been doing to followers of Christ. Russ, talk a little bit about the degree to which this really is a problem, not just in the Middle East, not just in China, not just in North Korea and elsewhere, but in our own hemisphere as well.
It's amazing that he mentioned it. You know, you're absolutely right, because he grouped Venezuela and Cuba together, which we have known for a long time, and you have pointed out to your listeners for a long time, but is now being more recognized, that there is a decline in freedom overall, and that includes religious freedom in both of those countries. As a matter of fact, preachers have been, archbishops have been attacked during Mass by unidentified assailants, presumably because they have spoken out against what is going on with the dictatorial nature of the Maduro regime.
Yeah, and it's not an accident, presumably, that they get away with these acts of violence. And speaking of Venezuela and the Maduro regime, of course, there are elections looming there without the opposition being on the ballot. So this will further finish off what's left of Venezuelan democracy. You follow this story very closely, Russ. We've benefited greatly over the years from your assessment of how dire the situation is, but there's a new development in the wake of Secretary Tillerson's visit to the region last week, our Secretary of State, that is quite noteworthy, and I want you to talk a little bit about it and what you think it portends. First of all, whether it was perhaps a product of the visit by Secretary Tillerson or not, but what's going on the borders of Venezuela in both Colombia and Brazil at the moment?
Both Colombia and Brazil have a great problem because they're being flooded by refugees from Venezuela, and I don't say that lightly. It's difficult to think of these kind of things unless you see it yourself, but here's the basic problem. The basic wage in Venezuela is $4 a month, and you can't feed your family or sustain yourself, even if you have a great job and you're making four times the basic wage, it's $16 a month. You can't feed your family, much less pay your cell phone or your rent or whatever. It's just not enough money. So people are fleeing the country because they don't have enough money to buy food, and they're flooding across the borders into Colombia and Brazil. This is a destabilizing influence on both of these nations. So in the wake of Secretary Tillerson's tour of Latin America, where he went to Colombia and Peru and met with Chile and Argentina as well, and even Jamaica, and then with Jimmy Morales when he came back to Washington, who also met with President Trump, there was a coordinated effort this weekend by both troops in Brazil and Colombia. There was a massive buildup of troops on the borders with Colombia, supposedly to stop the flow of refugees flooding into the country, which, you know, is bringing crime because they don't have jobs, they can't work there, they have no money, they have no food, they can't pay for medicine. It's a mess. And of course, Colombia wants to help and has been helping. There are over 400,000 Venezuelans have streamed across the border, according to Colombia's count, already. So you can imagine, though, that that's a massive humanitarian nightmare. There's no place for them to live. They're sleeping in the streets. They're robbing. It's, you know, they're doing what they have to do to survive in these countries. So it's causing a massive destabilizing influence. At the same time, the head of SOFCOM, Admiral Tidd, is currently in Bogota for talks there. So there is some anecdotal evidence that in the wake of Mr. Tillerson's call for tougher actions on Venezuela and the military buildups on the border and the fact that the head of SOFCOM is in Bogota and at the same time, that the region is toughening up in a serious way and taking the problem in Venezuela very seriously.
Yeah. Well, again, it has long seemed to be the case that the only possible outcome of this that will actually ameliorate the situation is the end of this Maduro regime. And if these military forces are being massed for the purpose of not only dealing with the border insecurity problem, which is, of course, acute, but also preparatory to doing something to help the people of Venezuela liberate their country from this regime, it would be a godsend indeed. Let me ask you, we spoke about Jimmy Morales. I have been told now for some time that his government is being actively subverted and destabilized, talk about regime change, by the United States State Department, specifically an ambassador there now moved on, of all places, to Venezuela by the name of Todd Robinson. What light can you shed on what's been going on there, Russ Dallin, and why we're doing that to what is a friendly government that, again, as you say, the president and the secretary of state met with Morales last week?
Yes, and President Morales is regarded as a friend. He was actually feted at the White House because he has announced his support for the movement of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. So that made Mr. Trump extraordinarily happy, and as well as the State Department.
Well, parts of the State Department, I can assure you, probably very small parts.
Yes. So, regarding the other issues, there is a difference. The State Department has one basic toolkit, and that's diplomacy. The president, on the other hand, has other tools available at his disposal. So you shouldn't be surprised if one side is pushing diplomacy when that's their tool and that's what they're paid to do.
Well, but the problem, as I understand it, Russ Dallin, and you're being diplomatic yourself, I think, is that the State Department has taken the view that this fellow Todd Robinson, a longtime Foreign Service officer, has promoted that Morales is corrupt and needs to be basically driven from office. And that doesn't seem to be borne out by the facts. And the diplomacy that is being used by this man, or has in the past now been used by this man, is, it would seem, very much at odds with American national interests and, for that matter, our security interests. So I'm glad to see he's gone. I do worry about him being our man in Venezuela at this very fraught moment, but that's a topic for another day. Russ Dallin, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for the work you do at the Latin American Herald Tribune. and Caracas Capital. It is great to have you with us always, and a learning experience for all hands. We'll talk to you soon. We'll talk to the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.